The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. It's my pleasure to introduce Connie Schultz. She joins us on the telephone in Cleveland, and she's just published her novel, The Daughters of Erie Town. Welcome to the program, Connie.
Thank you, Vic. It's great to be here.
Is this your first novel?
Yes, it is.
Wow. What happened? How did you decide to write a novel?
Well, It started quite some time ago. In 2007, right before my second book was about to come out, my editor at Random House, Kate Medina, invited me to lunch and wanted to talk to me about how the working class are really underrepresented in modern literature, working class people are. And I had to agree with that. I come from the working class, as I'm sure many of your listeners do, or are only one generation away from it. But I didn't see myself at that moment being somebody who could do something about it. Fortunately, she thought I could, and she wasn't going to give up on me. And it took a while for me to take it seriously. But once I did, it became a whole different thing for me to work on. It became a new dream professionally. And it took me a number of years to complete it. But here it is. It's finally here.
And that last book was a memoir and his lovely wife, right?
Yes, right, which came out in 07.
And that's the last time I interviewed you, and it was for the Dayton Daily News.
Oh, my goodness, that's right.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yes, it has.
How did this happen then as far as you're forming the story? Did you look back at your own life and pull out some little nuggets of things that you'd experienced, things that you'd observed? How did you put it all together?
Well, certainly there are moments of my experience that have found their way into the novel. This is true of most novelists, I suspect. The main professions of two of my main characters, Ellie and Brooke McGinty. Ellie is a nurse's aide, and Brooke is a utility worker, and those were the professions of my parents.
Mm.
So part of it is simply those are the professions I was most familiar with growing up. But also I wanted to pay tribute in a quiet way to them. My parents have been gone a long time now. My mom died at my age, actually, at 62. She's been gone almost 21 years now, and my dad died a few years after that. I went to Kent State. I was the first in my family to go to college, and I thought, why not have she's typically called Sam in the novel, why not have her go to Kent State? Because I know that drive really well from a small working-class town on the shore of Lake Erie. I know what it's like to have gone there at that time as a working-class kid. And so in those ways, I'm certainly drawing from my own experience, but the characters, they become something completely different from what I first think about, because, of course, I'm bringing my own experience into it initially, but then they evolve into someone else, which is how it should be with fiction.
And was that Ashtabula where you grew up?
I did. I grew up in Ashtabula. So it's my editor had really good advice, never make it about a town that actually exists. Everyone will tell you what you're getting wrong.
Uh-huh.
So Erie Town is certainly a version of Ashtabula, and there are nods to my hometown, but it is a fictional town, and it is unique unto itself in that way. It has some characteristics that are not going to be familiar to Ashtabula readers.
And your main thread involves this couple, Brooke and Ellie.
Yes.
And Brooke is... he's a charismatic character, but he's got his flaws. And if I had to pick a theme for this story in my mind, it would be forgiveness.
You know, I've been hearing that so much, and it has delighted me, but also surprised me, because I don't think I was really thinking about that. But of course, that's ending up being what it is, at least to some extent, because I do believe that, first of all, we're all flawed, and certainly all the characters in Erie Town are flawed, but we are bigger than our worst mistake. And forgiveness comes in play so much in our lives, either the lack of it or the grace of it. Sometimes we are the ones deciding whether we'll forgive, many times, frankly. Sometimes our lives are changed forever because somebody won't forgive us or somebody did. So now I can see, and I've thought about that and written about it in so many different ways over the years, often without even using the word forgiveness or forgive, that of course now it would make sense that that would bubble up as one of the themes. I just hadn't seen it myself until others started reading it.
My guest is Connie Schultz. Her novel is The Daughters of Erie Town. What is it about forgiveness? And it seems, in the book at least, that women are better at forgiving than men. Is it because men have so many things that need to be forgiven?
I don't know how to answer that exactly. I think women, most of us, certainly women of my generation, I'm a baby boomer, we were raised to focus on the relationships in our lives. And I don't think that's changed that much. I don't know that it's a gender trait of ours, but I certainly think it's a cultural one, that women tend to be focused on that a great deal. And so the issue of forgiveness becomes a primary one for us more often. I have been really heartened by the number of male readers who've been thanking me for having male characters who are complex and complicated and not just bad guys, which is kind of humorous because I don't know what they were expecting from me. I don't hate all men. But I did think it was important to show, you know, with Brick, one of the biggest people he's had to figure out if he's going to forgive or not without giving a plot line away is himself for his mistakes. But he also is so dependent, no matter how he treats her at different times in their relationship over the years, and this novel spans more than five decades, he's dependent on what Ellie thinks of him, even though she doesn't comprehend how important that is to him.
Tell us more about Brick and Ellie and their relationship and where they came from.
Well, because it was in the 1950s when they met in high school, and when Ellie gets pregnant, which is not giving anything away, it's at the very beginning of the book, the world was so different then, and that pregnancy changes both their lives, but it more dramatically affects the women, of course, because they have no options at that point, and they're completely dependent on what the man's going to decide he's going to do. Brick, of course, ends up not going to college on the basketball scholarship. He would have been the first in his small rural school, but he had very mixed feelings about it from the very beginning, and one of the storylines really is, who is he going to blame for that? And he goes back and forth. He could just have blamed himself for dragging his feet so much on it to begin with, or he can blame Ellie, or he can blame the fact of the pregnancy, or he can just blame the world. And in various forms, all that goes on with Brick over time. If I were to talk, you know, when I think about there are a couple of narrative arcs for the novel, and one of them is simply, but in some ways not simple at all, those of us who've lived it. The working class, those of us who come from the working class, we have hopes and dreams too. We have aspirations. We're not that different from people who are born luckier. The difference is when the problems come and we don't have the money to fix the problems. And that's the story of Ellie and Brick in a nutshell, is there was, you know, they lived in rural Ohio. The abortions may have been happening for women who were living in New York City at that time. It was never even an option. And Ellie's career was over, and Ellie couldn't, you know, wasn't going to be able to walk through commencement because she was pregnant. So much changed for her life instantly with this unplanned pregnancy. And that is such a common story. I mean, it was the beginning of my parents, although they were a year and a half out of high school. They weren't planning on me showing up when I did. And it does change lives. It's an earthquake in any relationship. And so I wanted to show that and help us understand that when you don't have any money that you can throw at things, it really can change your life. But it doesn't change your dreams. You just end up investing them so often in your children, whether they want them or not.
And that unplanned pregnancy causes them both to defer their dreams. His athletic scholarship is deferred, and he has to turn into one of these amateur softball stars to kind of get that athletic thing that he craves. And she wanted to be a nurse. And later in life, we see that she gets a chance to do something like that.
And, well, she's a nurse's aide, which is very different.
Right.
In terms of the work that's required of her, and also no union protection.
Right.
It's very rare for nurse's aides to belong to unions. And she goes to work because they realize even with Brick's well-paying union job, they have three more children after, excuse me, they have just Riley, but they just figure out that they're not going to be able to send Sam to college and still support all the changes, including buying a new home, unless Ellie goes to work too. This is another common narrative in my reporting over the years, and also in my own family, seeing what happens when men who were used to being able to support their families on their own have to concede that their wives must work. And it really does alter, for a lot of men, it alters how they see themselves, a lot of working class men. And I've been writing about this for many years.
Mm-hmm. Her book is The Daughters of Erie Town. Connie Schultz joins us. And we cover this wide arc of chronology here and experience. And there's all these wounds. The relationship changes between Brick and Ellie. She's wounded by him, and they keep trying to hold it together over this marriage. And you have a couple of younger characters who come into the story who really steal the show in this reader's view, and that is Samantha and Paul with two L's. And these are just wonderful characters. I love them.
Thank you.
Do you want to talk about them at all?
Well,
without giving away anything?
Yeah, we have to be careful about Paul Tuwels a little bit.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But, of course, he is an innocent but is the lightning rod for so much of this. And Sam is this daughter who grows up is born in the late 50s and is growing up during the feminist movement and all the change of the 60s. And so she and her father go at it, particularly over race. And she and her mother go at it to some extent just because Sam, in her unkind but typical teenager way, sees her mother as having accomplished so little in the world when things are breaking open for women from this teenager's perspective. That is not an unusual dynamic, of course, but I wanted to see it play out a bit, and I wanted readers to be able to cheer on both Ellie and Sam, and they land in very different places than each of them expects initially. And I had an awful lot of fun working on that relationship. I have to say it was a lot of fun to write.
And we also have a fairly tragic character in here who's connected with Paul, but I'm not going to say anything about this character.
I will say this about her, Rosemary. I've been touched by how many women say that they want to really be, they want to hate her, but they can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because they see her in her vulnerabilities as well, which is what you hope for when you write something like this. That nobody's, except for Brick's father, I don't think any other character is cast as somebody who you can have an immediate snap decision on, and that's it. I hope, anyway. That's the goal.
Well, we're kind of forced into being sympathetic with Brick because of the nasty father that he has, and Rosemary comes from a pretty tough background, and we feel sympathy for her despite the fact that later on she's kind of a manipulator.
Well, and one of the things that one of the themes that I hope comes through, though, because I feel it so strongly, is our roots are our beginnings, but they're not our excuses.
Mm.
And I would say that's particularly true, it should be, of Brick. I remember my agent at one point calling me and saying, she was reading a draft of my novel, and she said, "I am so mad at Brick right now." Because she wants to like him, but then he makes stupid mistakes,
mm-hmm.
makes really bad decisions. But I thought, well, that's exactly where you want your readers. You want them to think, oh, he could do better if he would just try harder. And I love hearing these conversations coming from readers now.
Oh, my. When I received your book, it had a itinerary of some stuff that you're going to do to publicize it, and I assume you have done this event with the libraries, Cuyahoga County and Lucas County. You must have did those remotely.
Every bit of my book tour was canceled in terms of in-person events, and I agree with that decision, and I hold to it to this day because I don't want, you know, we were just having a debate about this on Twitter because an author is starting to do some book tour for her. She said, for her fans, they deserve it. I just feel like anybody who wants to read my book is my job. Part of my obligation is to make sure they stay safe and the people who are around them remain safe. And I certainly don't, no matter how hard I've worked on this novel, I don't want anybody put at risk to buy it. My editor had a really good perspective on the whole notion of book tours. These book events are celebrations. They're parties, right? They're a fun thing to do. But the actual reading of the book and the selling of the book, that's something different. And we've been doing a lot of virtual I've done library events. I've done a number of bookstore events. I just did Gramercy Bookstore last night. It was a wonderful event with Ann Fisher interviewing me. Tonight I'll be doing Joseph Beth in Cincinnati virtually. It's a little bit easier in some ways in that I don't have to fly anywhere or drive anywhere. The New York events were canceled. The Washington events were canceled. And I'm sad that I won't see everyone. But I am so heartened by how many people are reading the book and responding to it. We just found out that the novel is debuting on the bestseller list for indie books, which is the independent booksellers.
Nice.
I can't say enough about how hard these independent booksellers around the country have been working for those of us who have new books coming out. I have been so touched by this. Max Bax in Cleveland Heights created a very safe environment where it's just two staff people and me so that I could go in and sign 550 books that were already pre-ordered. It's that kind of commitment to us is something I'm never going to forget. And even though I've always loved independent bookstores, I've certainly tried to use and order for them whenever possible. This time of this virus has really made me so much more keenly aware of the hard work of selling that they do and trying to come through for all their readers. And it's really been quite moving to experience this.
You mentioned Twitter. Of course, I follow you on Twitter. I know you have a lot of followers on there. And I follow you because, number one, I want to see photos of your dogs. And I want to see photos of your husband looking perplexed, trying to figure out his next Scrabble word. But you just mentioned this author. I haven't seen your Twitter feed today. Are you going to say this author's name that's going on?
No, and I'd rather not. I was drawn in by another author, and she was just asking, are any of us thinking of doing this?
All right.
And I'm not. I'm not going to do this right now. I just think it's not worth the risk to people. I don't think many of us will be doing it.
Sure.
I don't think it's well advised right now. I just think that we have to be protecting one another. And I want everyone to be wearing masks when they're out in public and keeping their distance whenever possible. We do know that if most people wear masks, we can definitely flatten the curve and eliminate a lot of the cases we must keep in mind also there are many people who are still dying of this virus. Mm-hmm. So how could I possibly justify that? For me, I can't. I'm not trying to go after anyone else. I'm just saying, for me, this is a hard no, because I want to protect readers, frankly, and staff who would have to be working with me to make this event happen.
Mm-hmm. You're up there in Cleveland, Connie. When you do go out, what percentage would you guess do you see people wearing masks? Half?
I go out rarely.
Okay.
I've been to the post office recently, mm-hmm. and I actually talked to the postal workers there. They said about 80% of people wear them. But
that's good.
See, that's not enough, mm-hmm. as you know.
Yeah.
And when I was there, I saw there were, I try to go earlier so that I don't have as many people in line with me. And what is striking to me is the ones who don't wear masks also don't care about distancing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see it go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I worry for the people who are working there. I worry, you know, I wish all customers were required to wear masks at all grocery stores, for example, because we're still requiring workers to, but that only means the workers are protecting us. We wear masks to protect others because so many people have the virus before they know it,
yeah.
and they're asymptomatic, and they don't even know yet that they're spreading it, and that's why we wear masks. So, you know, I'm just going to – twice today I've done the hashtag wear a mask on Twitter. I just – said on Facebook, I'm pleading with you, please wear a mask, because mm-hmm. there's a growing amount of evidence that shows that if we all wear masks, more people will live.
Well,
we've never been more powerful, think about it, as individuals and our ability to save lives.
It's a darn shame that wearing a mask has become a politicized act.
Well, I refuse to accept that it is, because
good.
Just as I don't think workers' rights should be politicized or women's rights or being opposed to racism should not be a political act, a partisan act, certainly trying to look out for people I will never know personally by wearing a mask in public should not be considered a political act. It is my looking out for you and you looking out for me. This is what it's supposed to be, in my view, what it's supposed to mean when we say we're Americans.
Mm-hmm. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have Connie Schultz on the phone with me. We're talking about her debut novel, The Daughters of Erie Town. Connie, of course, has written other books and a lot of other stuff. I think a lot of people know you from your columns. Do you want to talk at all about your journalistic background?
Just that I'm incredibly grateful to readers, particularly in Northeast Ohio, who are the reason I had this career to begin with. And I'm still writing my syndicated column once a week. I am so proud to have shared the mission of the work of journalism. I've always seen it that way, as a mission. And I am so sorry what's happened to the Youngstown Vindicator in the Youngstown area. This was so sad. And up here in Cleveland now, what's happening to the plane dealer, which launched my career. But I want to thank readers who continue to support local journalism. And more specifically, I want to thank them for having supported me for so many years. You didn't have to always agree with me. I certainly heard plenty of that. But I am so grateful for everybody who reads me.
Mm. And we probably have a few listeners out there who are saying, Vic, you mentioned Connie's husband, but you didn't say who he is. And I had the absolute pleasure of interviewing your husband last fall for his book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. And it was my favorite interview last year. He charmed me right out of my microphone.
You know, he worked really hard. Sherrod worked very hard on that book. And unlike many of his colleagues, he wrote it himself. We used to sit opposite each other at this big oak table we have in our house, working and writing and revising and talking over ideas. And he has read my book four times in four different versions. That's the husband I married. I'm telling you, he has been so supportive. I love his book, Desk 88. He is currently working on, they're getting ready to release the paperback this fall. And so he's writing a little bit of new stuff for it, and he's working so hard on that, in addition to everything else he's trying to do right now. And I always remind him, if it were easy, you wouldn't be a writer. I mean, that's what it means to be a writer, and you really do want to make every work count, and it's worth every bit of effort he's investing in it right now.
Well, I can remember reading Profiles in Courage by John F. Kennedy, and I really was flashing on that when I read Desk 88. It really seems to be the descendant of that book.
Well, that is high praise because, I would agree with you. I have to say that he really does single out, and he's very upfront about this, how he wishes he could be talking about women from Senate history past and people of color from Senate history past. But unfortunately, back then, it was all white males. But it's a great template for what we should aspire to in public service. And it also shows how people can change from who they are initially. As you know from the book, Hugo Black is a classic example of that.
Yep.
You start out one way. It doesn't mean you can't change. And again, I go back to our roots or our beginnings. They're not our excuses. And for many of us, we have to grow past our roots in some ways. Our roots of racism, for example, or sexism. I mean, there are many ways sometimes we have to branch out. And many of your listeners who are first generation to go to college certainly know what I mean, and it's illustrated in my novel as well, that we will always be straddling two worlds because you don't want to disrespect what you come from, but you also want to be true to who you've become through the opportunities you get when you move out and beyond your beginnings. It's a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Connie Schultz. Her novel is The Daughters of Erietown, and I like the way that you paid tribute to your mom's hairdo.
Definitely, Ellie's beehive is a tribute to moms. She was her beehive was a marvel. There's no other way to describe it. It was really a thing of wonder.
I like that feeling of nostalgia from reading your book to remember the music and to remember just the way things were, the food that we ate, and just the way life used to be. And it seemed like such a simple time in comparison to now.
Except that, and it is in some ways, except that the undercurrents that are in the book were the undercurrents that were always there. Again, we go back to racial tensions, for example, and tensions about women's roles and aspirations versus what society still expected of them, which was so much more limiting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And generational tensions that happened because of that. So in some ways, there never was a simple time, but there were in some ways. I mean, there are no cell phones in these chapters until much, much later in the book. And the music was so central to a family's life often. The entire family would listen to music together more often. So I'm aware of the differences and the changes, and family meals were more common, where everyone was expected to sit down at the dinner table at the end of the day. And I personally miss that. Of course, our kids are grown now, and I love it when we're all together. which hasn't happened in months and months because of the virus. But yeah, and the brand names and stuff, I did a lot of research on that. You think you remember certain things, but for example, when songs come out, you know, the copywriter was wonderful. She would occasionally write and say, actually, that song came out 4 months later. Well, that couldn't have been what they were listening to in that moment. It was just so important to get every little detail right.
I just have these little snapshots in my mind. Like, I can picture him, Brick, walking into the Italian restaurant and sniffing the air and going, okay, they're making this and they're making that and they're making this. And it just, it really, I started getting hungry when I...
Well, and it was food that was so different from the food he ate growing up, right? Because he grew up in rural Ohio. And it was not an Italian family, and so it was a lot of meat and potatoes, green beans, that kind of stuff. And then he walks into this Italian restaurant regularly, and he can smell these foods that he hadn't had before. And I remember, even for myself, when I started being able to buy all different types of lettuce. Sharon and I have talked about this. You know, when we were growing up, it was basically iceberg lettuce. And it was two or three types of dressing, French, Thousand Island, Italian. And then as I got older, we could find so much more in our markets. We could make our own dress. I mean, so much is different now in that way. And food, to me, is a great reference point in periods of time. Like Spam, Random House right now, we're about to launch the book club little online guide. And one of the things I talk about is I share a Spam recipe from that time that my mom used to fix. And her favorite new drink she discovered, which was the grasshopper. And I remember her being so excited, calling me when she had gone out with my dad in the 60s. It must have been towards the late 60s, maybe early 70s. And she couldn't wait to tell me she had just had a new drink. It's green, and it's called the grasshopper. So we included that recipe as well, because food is a part of our times, is it not? I mean, some things are universal, but some things are really of their moment. And certainly Spam is not – it's still eaten. And, of course, it started as a – food for men at war. But in the 60s and 70s, so many working class families were using it and serving it, particularly during strikes or tough times. And they would come out with these cookbooks, these little pamphlets to show you other things you could do with Spam.
The grasshopper, is that with creme de menthe? I don't know this.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. I was just guessing from the color. Well, how fun. So do you think maybe there's another novel in you someday?
Oh, I'm already working on my...
Are you?
Yes, I am. Of course, I have to. It's the only way to keep my agent, my editor, from constantly nagging me. I am, but it's not a sequel to this book. I've been already asked about that quite a bit. I don't rule out a sequel to The Daughters of Erie Town. It's just not where I'm going with the second one.
Well, you mentioned the book clubs, and I'm guessing that this is going to be a staple with book clubs. This just seems like an ideal story for them.
Well, thank you. We've just today I was talking with Random House. I'm going to swoop in on some Zoom book clubs in the next few weeks. And we're trying to figure out how we let people know that and how we pick them. But I'm really looking forward to hearing these in-depth discussions about the Daughters of Erie Town.
When you say swoop in, are they going to be having their club meeting and then suddenly you're just going to pop up in a window?
Well, they'll know I'm coming. But yeah, they're going to be meeting by Zoom and I'll be scheduled to show up.
How fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you again after all these years, Connie.
Well, thank you. And thank you. You have done so much for authors over the years. Like, you've never given up on us. And I'm so grateful that you took the time.
It's really one of the great pleasures of my life, talking to writers about their work.
And thank you for reading the book. It was clear that you read the book, and that means a great deal to me.
I loved it.
Thank you.
I highly recommend it. The book is The Daughters of Erie Town by Connie Schultz, who has been my guest on the program today. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.